Good afternoon. This is Use Your Words, Authors Speak. I'm Elise Stewart, and we also have Richard Mahler here with us today, and we are interviewing Bruce Wilson with his new book that's just coming out. It's called Death in the Black Patch.
Bruce, you're a professor of history at Western New Mexico University.
I am. I teach American history, primarily the survey courses for the freshmen and sophomores. I get to teach upper division courses on occasion, but yes, I am. A history professor. I love history. I always have.
And your novel, your historical novel, is just about to come out, Death in the Black Patch. Can you give us a really brief summary of
what it's
about?
Sure. And we get all trained for this. When you write a novel, you have to learn to do an elevator pitch, which is a 30-second summary of your book.
Here's your chance.
Yeah, so here's my chance. Death in the Black Patch is an historical novel that takes place in Kentucky in 1906. And it tells the story of a poor tobacco farmer who is caught in the middle of an economic war. That war is between the American Tobacco Company and the various farmers' cooperatives where they tried to hold back their product. And the main character's inability to actually deal with the pressure and make a decision on what to do with his crop, either sell it or to hold it back, ultimately leads to a pretty tragic ending.
Bruce, before I read your book, in its manuscript form, being that it's not quite out yet, I didn't know anything about the tobacco wars. I never heard of it. This is the early 1900s. I didn't know anything. Could you speak to that just a little more to explain to people what that was?
Of course, yeah. The Black Patch, of course, is a region of western and Tennessee and western Kentucky. Some 30 counties that all grew a special kind of tobacco that was used primarily in pipe tobacco and plug, as opposed to cigarettes. The lesser grade tobaccos like the Burley in the other part of Kentucky and Virginia and North Carolina was used primarily for cigarettes. But this black patch tobacco was very highly demanded by the tobacco companies. It took a special kind of treating at the end. Instead of just drying it in the drying barn, they actually dried it with oak chips smoking in the bottom of a drying barn. And so by 1904, James B. Duke of Duke University fame and Duke Power fame had created a monopoly in the Black Patch, and he had bought out all the competition, even drove away the international market, and was consuming this tobacco as much as he could buy at a cost below the cost to produce the tobacco. So many of the farmers didn't know what to do. Most of them were either illiterate or semi-literate. The larger farms were owned by people who were educated and had, you know, 50 acres instead of, or 500 acres instead of 40, had formed cooperatives, or the Planters Protective Association. And these folks had the plan, if we hold back our tobacco and not sell it to James B. Duke, then we'll wait until we get a good price. And so lots of farmers actually joined the associations. Many did not, because they had large families, they had large debts, and they needed to sell their tobacco,
right,
to be able to pay those debts. So with some of those farmers not joining, and those farmers who didn't join were known as hillbillies. That's where the term comes from. And when they would not hold back their tobacco with the association, the association had a secret society part of that, and these folks were known as night riders. When you see them with their masks on and their torches in hand, you think Klan, and they were very similar in the activities that they did, but more driven towards convincing and educating the hillbilly farmers to join the association. And that lasted from basically 1904 through 1909, and finally in 1911, under the Sherman Antitrust Act, the U.S. government told Mr. Duke that he had created a monopoly, and that was against the law.
Wow.
So we're sitting in southwestern New Mexico. It's a long way to Kentucky. It's a long way to any place that grows tobacco. So what's your connection with this story? Is it personal? Is it as a historian?
You know, Well, it's actually both. The first time I ever heard about the Black Patch War was long after I heard the original story that drove me to write the book. The Black Patch War information, I really started to become aware of it about 2006. It had to do with me wanting to do a little background information on my family. My wife and I lived in Indiana at the time, and we took a weekend trip to Kentucky, went to the place where my grandparents were both born, Linville, Kentucky, which is in the Black Patch. And I started to read stuff about that, and I understood a little bit more, and it gave me a really interesting idea as an historian to maybe present some kind of a scholarly work on the Black Patch War. Again, not happening in New Mexico, but there was quite a bit of work already out there of historical nature in looking at it. Mm-hmm. But when I was a young man, very young, maybe 6, 7, 8 years old, my dad used to tell us stories, and I was the oldest of six kids, so he was always sitting us down telling us stories. And he would get to this one story that I think I reduced one time down to about 14 words is what kept coming back to my head every couple of years, and I can't say it here because it would give away the end of the story. But this legend in the family, my dad either couldn't or wouldn't enlarge. He would never tell us any more than those same 14 words. And so it stuck with me for a while, and after you get adults and have children, you forget about it. And then when I took that trip in 2006 to Kentucky, I decided to ask some questions about that, and we actually were able to get some information. The day we showed up in Linville, in this crossroads town, and that's exactly what it is. It had a gas station, the old-fashioned kind, with the office and the two service bays on mm-hmm. one corner, a post office on another, and then on a third corner with this large brick building. So we went to the post office first to find out if any Wilsons lived still in the area, and the postmistress said, "I don't know, I'm not from here." So she said, "You might go over to the gas station, maybe they can help you." So we went over there, and I pushed open the door, and the little bell jingled over the top of the door, and there were these two old guys sitting in really worn out, beaten down office chairs. I didn't know if they were alive. They were asleep, and there were flies buzzing around their head, and I thought, you know, maybe the ringing the bell again would help. But anyway, they woke up, and I asked the same question, and they hemmed and hawed and said something like, "It seems to me that something happened over to the building over there," and they sent us up to the county seat at Mayfield. We went to the library ultimately, and actually a person sitting in the library at the same time turned out to be one of my fifth cousins.
Oh, gosh.
Said, "Let me show you something." Led us to the microfilm reader, opened it up, and here's the front page paper on the day following the event that ends my story. So again, for another 8 years, I just pondered what to do. But then finally, in 2014, Mary and I went to Tucson to the Tucson Festival of Books, which we had been doing ever since we came to Silver City, and went to a panel discussion on writing fiction about real events. And afterwards, I went up to talk to one of the authors, and she asked me what I was working on. She must have thought I was a writer. And I said, "Well, I've been thinking about writing this," and she stopped me mid-sentence and said, "Stop thinking, start writing." So that was a Saturday, the 13th of March of 2014, and on Monday morning, I got up and started writing, and I wrote every day for 10 months and ended up with my first draft.
So why write a novel rather than write an academic treatise, something totally nonfiction?
Really, because I should have, you know, given my background and everything, I should have been something scholarly, a white paper or something like that. But when she asked me the question the way she did, I was actually, I think, embarrassed into doing it. I had said, as long as I've been writing, I don't have a novel in me. But with the idea, the context of the Black Patch War, to give it a grander venue, if you will, and now the ending was already there. All I had to do was to create a story. And what I ended up doing was writing those first words and then following the story as it grew on its own. And ended up with, after, you know, several rewrites and help from people like Elise to improve the work, you know, cut it by about 15% down to a workable 110,000 words. But it just seemed the right thing. You know, it was one of those things. I never thought I could do it, and here I was doing it. Writing the novel was really fun. I mean, the first draft was just going and going and going. You write every day, and you're doing something with it. Then letting it sit for 2.5 months without doing anything, not even trying, not even to think about it, letting it stew, following the advice of many, many accomplished writers. And then you start the rewrite and you realize how much poor writing you have done.
But also good.
As it turns out, yeah. Again, with totally like 5 or 6 rewrites, it does work out pretty well.
So after you started researching, and you'd already done that, and then you had this connection to your family, too, how did that kind of unfold? Have you met more of your family since you started this book, or is in the publishing process?
I've met more of my family in the last few weeks since various newspapers and things on Facebook and the Internet have happened. But no, I actually went into it pretty cold relative to the knowledge of the family. I had done a lot of genealogical work, so I knew who these people were, but I, you know, most of them were dead. My cousins didn't have much to share, at least on the Wilson side of this, the family tree. So I had to do a lot of creative work in how do I take the main character, my great-grandfather, and mm-hmm. how do I personify him? How do I give him a character? I thought about my own father. Certainly, I understand genetics and understand that there's a lot of traits of physical traits that get passed down through the various generations. And I knew my own dad personally and all the good things and the bad things about him. He used to tell me about his own father. I mean, I knew my grandfather as a sweet old man. Well, my dad remembered my grandfather when he was not a S-O-M, sweet old man, but an S-O-B, right? And he would tell me these things about my grandfather. I hope that was all right to say.
That was very good. So
I started to think about maybe putting characteristics of my father or my grandfather, and I assumed at one point it sort of took over, and my great-grandfather's character came out as probably like the progenitor of these kinds of things. So I just created him as if he had been my great-grandfather, and that was kind of odd, but that's how it worked out. My great-grandmother, I decided to make her a sweet woman. All the kids I had to protect. You know, I still have relatives who know these
right.
people.
And they're
and
still
then
alive.
And certainly one of the people involved in the actual event at the end of the book was a relative of theirs, and I had to protect him as well.
Wow. Well, I remember the characters really stand out in the book, and particularly Wes, who's the main character, was very alive and very, very real. So I think you did a really good job of creating
him. Thank you. And I'm certainly hope other people understand that when they read this, especially my relatives.
Yes.
The person we're talking to is Bruce Wilson. The book is called Death in the Black Patch. And I understand you're going to have a book signing and launch here in Silver City pretty soon.
We are. It's going to be a week from Wednesday at the 21st, Wednesday the 21st at 6 p.m. at Trey Rosat, just down the street. There are going to be free appetizers, and then I think King is going to have a cash bar, but I think that maybe if anybody was interested, I might supply a little bit of moonshine, since moonshine also takes part in this book. So if you're looking for a taste of moonshine, there might be some.
Well, we were just going to take a very short break. We're here with Bruce Wilson. Death in the Black Patch is his first book, and we'll be right back in just a minute. Thank you for listening.
Back on Use Your Words. Use Your Words is a twice a month program about local literature and the literary scene in southwestern New Mexico. And we're talking today with Bruce Wilson about his book, Death in the Black Patch. Now, the events you're describing occurred basically about a century ago in western Kentucky. And although I'm not that familiar with that part of the country, I know that memories are long, and I'm wondering if you have any trepidation about how that community is going to respond to your book, or whether you're planning any appearances or readings in that area, and how do you feel about bringing these subjects up?
There was a moment when I wanted to really rethink the whole idea of writing the book, but I kept going at it, and the story seemed to grab me. And when I finally went back in the midst of writing my first draft, I went back to Kentucky by myself for a weekend or so, and I walked in the tobacco fields, and the tobacco plants at the time were really just a couple of weeks ahead mm-hmm. of what they are mm-hmm. in the story. And so I walked down those country roads. I went to cemeteries. I actually met a fifth cousin once removed. He was a same age as my children, and so we shared the same ancestry. It goes back even further back than my great-grandfather. So wow. I talked to this young man, and he was sort of the spokesperson for his family. But when he and they learned I was writing this story, they were excited. They wanted somebody to tell a story of any kind about our family. And so I promised him, like I was mentioning before the break, I promised him that I would care for the history that I create. I know what happens to these men. I know how their lives went, but I did not know them as people. And so when I wrote the story, I paid particular attention to how I represented these people. There were a lot of conflicts and other things, too. There were name similarities between my great-granduncle's wife's name and my great-grandfather's daughter. So I had to change a name. Some people, I had no idea what they were like. I had never seen pictures of them, so I created a visualization of them. Now, when I have now, in the last 2 months, spoken to some of these cousins who are truly coming out of the woodwork to see me when I get to Kentucky, and I'm going to go back. And I've explained to them, please understand that this is a work of fiction. You know, the caveat, I said, it's a work of fiction. I had to do a lot of creative work. And they said, I don't care. I mean, you didn't know, so you wrote the best you could. So we just want to hear the story. So the day after the book signing event down the street at Trey Rosat, Mary and I are going to get on a plane, fly to Kentucky. We're going to be at the Graves County Public Library in Mayfield, the county seat where all this happened, on a Friday night at like 5 o'clock for a library event. People are going to come and hopefully buy my book. And then spend the night there. And then the next day we drive down to Hopkinsville, Kentucky, to the Hopkinsville Christian County Public Library, where they have an annual Black Patch War pilgrimage, a big event. And there's going to be some 800 to 1,000 people there. And another author who's written a memoir family history about the tobacco wars in the Burley region of tobacco, we're going to share a stage, and we're going to put on a program about the book. So I have relatives that are going to show up at both events, and wow. they're going to, I think, mostly they just want to have a book signed by a person, you know, that they might know. So, but I'm pretty excited about going back to Kentucky to do that. I've got other events planned in the future, but sure. some of those are local. But this is, in Kentucky, it's going to be the most meaningful to me.
Well, it's kind of interesting that you went with your wife at first. Mm-hmm. You went then by yourself as you were writing, and now you're going as the finish.
I'm going to go back this time with boxes of books. Hope they come home with empty boxes.
Absolutely. But that's what we all wish for you.
Which is interesting, because I know a lot of people I know that write and have written books, and they've been very popular. They've made some money on it. Making money will be okay for me. I just want people to read the story. I work a lot to finish it, and I would like people to look at that book and read it and say, wow, that was really good.
Well, there's a lot of history, and like I said, for me, that I didn't know. I knew nothing about it, and the Knight Riders are, yes, reminiscent of the Klan and the things that they did to make people go along with them. Mm-hmm. It was terribly unfair. So it will be teaching people as well, you know, it'll be educational as well as a great story. So I think that's very, many facets of this.
Well, I think
novel.
That's what obligation that we have as writers of historical fiction. We have to be very, very specific and honor that history, the era in which something took place. Mm-hmm. We have to look at things like technology, literacy, family values, how they're different than they are today. It's like when I'm teaching my history students that we're going to go back and look at the Gilded Age, for instance. they can't look at the problems with their 21st century brains. They have to put on a 19th century brain to try to understand why people would even agree to do something like Jim Crow laws or something like that. So mm-hmm. I had to do the same thing. I have to go back in there and honor the period and the technology and the people and the use of language. Otherwise, anything I create is just pure fiction. And then somebody might try to rely on the history, and if it's false history, then I've done a disservice. But the fiction part, you know, creating characters, and I did a number of them. I made people up. That's the fun part of it. Yeah. I can create as bad a guy as I want, as long as I make him talk like he should have talked, wear the clothes he should have worn. Mm-hmm. They all drank anyway, so then the Southern culture of violence, you put those two together, moonshine and arguing and guns, and you end up with pretty good stories.
Are the tobacco wars over? You're talking about events of a century ago, but you're mentioning this big corporation that's coming in trying to drive the little guy out of business. So if they're still growing tobacco there, what's the economic situation for a small farmer?
Yeah, there's a lot of things that allow the tobacco industry. You know, right now it's government regulation that's giving the tobacco farmers in the regions a fit more than the actual commercial relationships.
How so?
Well, again, the restrictions on the sales of tobacco and the uses of tobacco, they have to cover all of their, not only in the planting. In the past, they would dig a hole and, you know, and put the seed in and grow a little shoot and then transplant that shoot into the field until it matured, went through the physical handling of the tobacco from start to finish. Now with equipment and fertilizers and everything, it's a lot different than when the dirt was just dirt. Mm-hmm. And so I would say that from a pricing standpoint, the things I followed in the last several years is they make their money. They do very well. Far fewer people are growing tobacco, and it's becoming the large corporate farm type of thing that where it happens.
Mm-hmm. So what process did you go through to get your book published, Bruce?
And that's another great story, too. Again, thinking the worst case, and I don't mean to disrespect people who do self-publish, but in my own mind, if I had to self-publish just to get my book out, I was going to do that. But at the Southwest Festival of the Written Word last fall, I was on a committee, and one of my duties was to spend time in the vendor room, making sure that all the vendors that were there could get the things that they needed from us as a committee. So I met this one publisher, Jeff Habiger from Artemisia Publishing, and I talked to him a couple of times over the course of the festival about what I was doing, and he seemed interested. He had a stable of about 15 authors that he was working with, and he published things like coloring books for children. He published sci-fi, young adult literature, some adult mysteries, but he'd never done anything that was historical fiction. So we talked, and I thought that I might like to work with him. He was personable, and he explained his way of doing business. He actually sent me a blank contract to look at, so I had a sense of how he did business. Mm-hmm. And so I kept him posted on my progress, and when I finished the first draft, I told him, and he said, just stay in touch. So after you and your fellow beta readers had my book in December and then January of this year, I did that last rewrite and submitted, following his directions, you know, two chapters and a summary and marketing plan and so on. And he had it for about 10 days and sent me an email, said, I want to publish your book. And I thought, I had to look over my shoulder.
Great.
It was a wonderful thing. It really was. So
yes.
We met
wonderful.
In early April, signed the contract. And since the first part of April, we've been doing the final edits that went to a copy editor for a while and, you know, created cover art. I built my platform, you know, the platform that they all look for. So that was unheard of to me, because everything you hear, all the horror stories about taking 10 years to write a book and then rejection after rejection after rejection from publishers, you end up doing a self-publishing thing. And right. I first shot out of the box, I get a publisher, and I don't have to put up any money up front. And, you know, I mean, I have to do things like, you know, pay for an ad in Desert Exposure or
right.
buy appetizers down at Trey Rosat, but that's the stuff I can handle.
Right.
Artemisia, is that the publisher?
Artemisia Publishing, yeah.
In New Mexico, isn't
it's
it?
Tejeras, New uh-huh. Mexico.
Oh, great.
And Jeff is, this is a side business for him. He's an international tech consultant. First time I sent my submission to him, he was in Indonesia or someplace. So, but he,
wow.
He's very exciting to work with, and his publishing company's got 3 books come out this summer. One in July, one in August, and mine in September. So things are working pretty well for him.
That's wonderful. How did you find or make time to write when you're already working?
Well, I spent 35 years in corporate America, so I knew how to manage my time. I've always been a stay-up-late, get-up-early guy, maybe 5 hours of sleep a night. So when I started that first time in the beginning, or, you know, the first part of March, mm-hmm. I would get up in the morning at 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock. I'd start writing for 2 or 3 hours, then yeah. I'd get ready to go teach school.
That's so great.
Yeah, and the morning was the best time for me.
Mm-hmm.
It always was, so I have freedom. The computer's there. You know, nobody.
It's quiet.
It's very quiet, or I could just take my hearing aids out. Either way, it works the same.
And make it quiet.
Yeah.
That is so great. Do you have some plans for a future book?
Actually, I do. I was just working on my opening sentence in the last couple of days, and I've got one in line. I'm going to take one of my fictional characters, and I'm going to get him out of Kentucky, and you would recognize him, and you'd know he had to get out of Kentucky, mm-hmm. and I'm going to try to send him out here to the West, maybe maybe to Juarez or to Douglas or something like that.
That sounds so exciting. I want to thank you, Bruce, for being with us today. I know you're really busy and just engulfed in your book, and that's a wonderful thing, and really appreciate your coming to visit with us.
And you have a website, right?
I do have a website.
BruceWilsonWrites.com.
BruceWilsonWrites, www.BruceWilsonWrites.com.